Recently, my wife Sydney and I had occasion to stay with some good friends at their home, and they had a home theater, and they showed a DVD of a George Strait concert that took place in the Cowboy Stadium about 5 years ago. Apparently, it was a farewell concert. He had a lot of other country and western stars that joined him. But we watched that concert. There are a lot of good music there, but one song is stuck in my mind, and I wasn't that aware of George Strait's songs, but this one song, Give It Away, continues to circle back and forth in my song. And if you're not familiar with it, it's actually kind of got a stern subject matter. It's a husband and wife who have decided to dissolve their marriage, and the wife simply says, give it away. Everything in this house, just give it away. It's not worth it. All these cherished items that supposedly represented all the years together, she says, just give it away. Just give it away. I thought about that refrain this past week when I saw a story of a billionaire by the name of George Feeney. George and his wife Helga, he had created these duty-free stores that you see in the airports so that travelers who are returning or far away, they can buy an item, get on the plane, and not have to pay a duty on it. And he got rich, very wealthy, $9 billion. And somewhere in the midst of all of that accumulation of money, something happened to him. He had an experience that caused him to change his goal. He decided, instead of desiring more and more money, that his goal would be to give it away. Just give it away. And this past week, he and his wife signed a document that represented the success, the attaining of that goal. They'd given away $9 billion. And now they're broke, or relatively broke, living in a modest apartment in San Francisco with a modest net worth. The $9 billion represented 375,000% of what he now is worth, and he gave it all away. Why did he do that? Ultimately, because his heart told him that he would be better off, that he would feel good about giving to universities and hospitals and charities, and life would be better. He was seeking, as we all do, the abundant life. So hear this text regarding another individual, the Apostle Paul, as he continues to seek the abundant life for him. It comes out of the book of Acts, chapter 17, verses 16 through 21. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. And a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to debate with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we would like to know what they mean." All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. May the Lord bless the reading of this word. So Paul had been there in Athens, which was known for philosophers, Socrates, all these great philosophers and their strains of thought. Paul was in the big leagues as he walked there to present his own ideas, indeed to present the gospel of Jesus Christ. But nobody had heard it before. It wasn't familiar. It was foreign. And not only that, he was rather brash about it. He had seen an idol or a statue. Remember, the Greeks were polytheistic in that they believed in many gods. And they honored all the different gods with statues, and just in case they'd left one out, they had a statue that said, "To the unknown God." Sort of as an insurance policy, don't you know? So Paul walks up and said, "I'm going to talk about, I see that you're honoring the unknown God. Let me tell you my God, whom you obviously do not know. My God is the one God, not many gods, but the one God who has created all of this, without whom we do not exist, we do not move, we do not breathe. And he began to talk about what God has done in Jesus Christ. And he even talked about the judgment day and how we would be held accountable for our choices in this life. And so he was scorned. People laughed at him. Others said, well, we need to hear more about that. And finally, after he was done, a small percentage of the people who had heard came forward and said they wanted to believe in Jesus Christ. What fascinates me about this story in the life of the Apostle Paul is the understanding that in a way he had it made. Paul was raised in Tarsus in Asia Minor. His father was prominent. It was a university town. He excelled as a scholar. He learned not only his Hebrew, being a Jew, but he also knew Greek and Latin. He was a Roman citizen. He had so many privileges, you might say. He was so far ahead of the game, and then when he went to Jerusalem, he was a member of the Sanhedrin, the authoritative body of the Jews. He had authority. He had prestige. He had it going on. And Paul, as a young man, found himself sitting there by the coats of the others who had discarded their coats so that their throwing arm would not be impeded as they stoned Stephen, the Christian. This Christian who was going about talking this crazy theory that Jesus, the mystical rabbi, was somehow the Messiah, who was foretold by the Hebrew prophets that Jesus was that person and that he had been raised from the dead after his crucifixion. This gospel, so-called good news, was so much an affront and was so offensive to Saul that he decided that he would spend his life persecuting Christians. He would stamp out this heresy. He would maintain the integrity of the faith, the orthodoxy of the faith that was dominant there in Jerusalem. And he was on his way to Damascus, having gotten warrants sworn out for the arrest of Christians, when he had an experience that literally drove him to his knees. In Damascus, he heard the voice of Jesus saying, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" He fell to the ground. He was blinded. He did not speak for 3 days. Ananias sought him out and began to teach him about what God had done in Jesus and taught him about the gospel. And Saul adopted his Latin name, Paul, and decided he would change his goals completely. No longer would he be the enforcer, the goon who went about persecuting Christians, but instead he would embrace his understanding as a Jew of all the Hebrew prophets, but he would also have the understanding that Jesus was the fulfillment of those prophecies. This was a good news that was not accepted by many of the Jews, and so there was a disagreement within the Jews. And Paul, who had been lifted up and was a member of the Sanhedrin, now found himself on the receiving end of persecution. How ironic was that? He who sat by the coats of those who stoned Stephen to death, now he knew the taste of persecution. And yet such was his faith. And such was his sense of calling that Paul would travel 10,000 miles throughout Asia Minor, founding churches, some 17 churches, all for the purpose of proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ, all for the purpose of making the unknown God known. He made constant reference in his epistles to the thorn in the flesh. Scholars aren't really sure what that was. Some people said it was a physical infirmity. Maybe he walked with a limp. Maybe he had a pain. Maybe it was an internal spiritual struggle that was constantly tormenting. Whatever it was, he would make reference to the thorn in the flesh that impeded him but did not hold him back from doing what he needed to do, from fulfilling his mission. To make known the unknown God, to talk about the God revealed in Jesus Christ. It was a unique and interesting God that Paul preached. He talked about how in the crucifixion, God took the initiative, that the God who invited through the prophets, invited people to obedience and righteousness, was disappointed because the people never quite got there. They never quite attained righteousness in and of themselves with their own effort. So God takes the initiative and says, you know what? You're never really going to get this right. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to cross the gulf between us, and through the sacrifice of my son, I'm going to expiate, not propitiate my anger and my wrath, but in a gift of grace and love and joy, I'm going to erase any sense of shortcoming or debt on your part. And now all you have to do is believe in the gift of grace and accept it and become a believer in what I have done in Christ. What I admire about Paul was it must have been intimidating to go into the Athenian marketplace where he was a total unknown, without any fanfare or any introduction. He got up and began to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, knowing that there would be people who would listen to him, look him in the eye, and say, "You're just totally crazy. You don't know what you're talking about," and be rejected, which is what happened in many cases. That's always the challenge of the marketplace, isn't it? It's intimidating to go out and preach on the street corner. John Wesley knew that. When he preached on Aldersgate Street and talked about his strange warming of the heart, it's always a present possibility that someone will look you in the eye and say, "I don't believe a word that you're saying. It happened to Jesus. Why wouldn't it happen to us?" It's easier to stay inside and embrace the orthodoxy of the status quo, to look around in the small cadre of believers and say, "Well, at least we believe. Those others out there, you know, I kind of wonder about them. I question their faith, and I'm beginning to wonder about you." It becomes a solitary, lonely exercise, that type of evangelism. I once heard that the four stages of a religious movement were like this. It begins with a charismatic individual. Then it moves into discipling other individuals who surround to help go out and spread the message, spread the good news. And then it moves to the codification of doctrine and then the calcification of the entire movement. Paul made a choice. He was a member of the Sanhedrin. He could have stayed and reveled in the prestige and the recognition that he received. He could have continued to be an enforcer of the existing orthodoxy. For whatever reason, because of his Damascus experience, he chose the harder way. He chose to go out and risk rejection, to incur hardship, the beatings with rods, the persecution, being thrown in prison, the hunger, the nature of being shipwrecked, and go out and found churches in the name of Jesus Christ. Now, one of the things that I love about this congregation, this people of God, known as Highland Park United Methodist Church, is that their history shows that year in and year out, decade after decade, they have given themselves away. They have founded over 45 churches. 45 other churches at great expense to themselves, when they could have simply been about the business of simply staying here on the corner of Hillcrest and Mockingbird and reveled in being the Highland Park United Methodist Church and celebrated that with all of the recognition and authority and status quo that that brings. Instead, they are constantly sending forth missionaries and emissaries to go out and start missions to do service in the name of Christ Jesus and also to start new churches. They give themselves away. And that's what it's all about. Now, I'd like to talk to you this morning about another Paul Rasmussen, our senior minister. If you're like me, you saw Paul's video this past week. I'd had some preparation. He had talked to me before, but that didn't discount the impact at all. As he stood there in his study, in his office, in front of his desk, and shared with us very transparently that he had received a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, and that he wanted us to know that. He wanted us to know that he was taken aback a little bit, but he needed some time and space, but he was going to get a handle on it. He saw this as a platform for his future ministry, and that he would soon return and be with us and continue in his role as our leader. In my 7 years that I've been here on staff working for and with Paul, I've not only found him to be a very effective leader, but also an endearing friend, a colleague, and a pastor. And I know that you feel the same way. I don't know what Paul's Damascus experience was in Shreveport. Probably it had something to do with his family tree. You know, he's a fourth generation United Methodist minister. Whatever it was, in the year 2000, he came to Dallas with Ashley at age 32, and he started a seminary at Perkins School of Theology. And he also came over here looking for a job, and somehow he got an appointment with Mark Craig. And I can recall, I didn't verify all of this, Susan, with Paul, because he would have told me, don't do that. You know, the way he would have said, John, don't talk about me in your sermon. But if I recollect, he said that he went in to speak with Mark Craig and shared something about, well, I'm kind of inquiring. I'm looking into this ministry thing. I've started seminary. And Mark, being Mark, said, well, I don't even want to hear that. Are you going to do it or not? You need to make a decision. Are you going to do it or not? And Paul was taken aback. He said, well, okay, I'm going to do it. Well, then, okay. I've got a job for you. You're going to go over to the Biggers building, and you can kind of look after the basketballs and sweep the floors over there. And so then he began his employment here at Highland Park United Methodist Church. I would imagine that there was a time, you see, he'd been coaching basketball in his first career. There was probably a time when he was sweeping the floor and looking after the equipment. He said, my gosh, I was coaching basketball a few years ago, and now I'm an equipment manager. I'm going in the wrong direction. But at a staff meeting, Mark had said, and Paul was gathering, he wasn't ordained, but he was gathered with other clergy, and Mark had said, who wants to, I've got a job for somebody, you could call it TV ministry. You see, the sanctuary's overflowing, so we've got an overflow area. Somebody needs to roll out the television and turn it on, and maybe have a benediction in there with that group of people. Who would like to do that? A lot of people weren't quick to raise their hands, but Paul did, and so he was put in charge of that service, and shortly after was named to start the contemporary service in Cornerstone. And you know what happened there. The growth was phenomenal. Mark Craig had continued in the tradition of starting new churches. He just happened to start this church on the campus of the existing church here in the sanctuary, Cornerstone. And it grew and it grew and outgrew its venue. And finally, they had to do an entire renovation of the facility to accommodate in Wesley Hall, Cornerstone. And I recall having been a newcomer to this North Texas Conference, being at a district meeting in DeSoto, sharing a hymnal with Mark Craig at a district meeting. And Mark stopped singing and he nudged me and he pointed to a youngish looking guy in front of us, in the pew in front of us, who was singing at the top of his lungs, not necessarily on key, But he said to me, you see that fella right there? And I said, yeah. He said, I sent him to start a contemporary service a few years ago, and now he's out drawing me. And he said it with a note of paternal pride. Phenomenal growth to worship in a new way, not to discard traditional worship, not at all, but in addition to traditional worship, to find a way, they call it seeker worship, to bring people to Christ using a format that was different, that might possibly reach them and speak to them in a different way. Now, I recall being at a meeting, a district meeting or a conference meeting, down in the basement of the youth room, and Paul was in attendance there, and Bishop Bledsoe was talking about annual conference. Excuse me. And Paul said to the bishop, Bishop, as long as the annual conference is as boring as it is, I really am reluctant to recruit good lay people to spend their time to even attend. And I moved away because I was afraid lightning would come down and strike, you know, strike Paul or whatever, and I didn't want to be collateral damage on that. But as so often happens, the bishop thought for a second, and he said, well, you're probably right. I'm going to put you in charge of next year's annual conference. And so I looked with interest to what that was going to look like, and I'll never forget it. I don't remember the venue, Susan. Was it? It may have been Plano Center. And we're up there on the stage. You've got the Cornerstone Band with Kate Miner fronting it as doing vocals. And they broke into Journey's Don't Stop Believing, a rock song. And they blew the doors off the entire venue. They did a great job, a great rendition of the song. And when they were done, it was like crickets. People, their jaws dropped. Everybody was in shock. What just happened? Who are those people? I didn't know you could do that at annual conference. But that was, again, that was an external sign of the internal reality that Paul Rasmussen is an innovator. Paul says the mission is always the same. The model changes. The means of getting there changes. That can be different, but the mission is always the same. The apostle Paul said that the mission is to make our God known. And that mission, 2,000 years later, is exactly the same. Our passion, our mission is to make God known to so many people, the God revealed in Jesus Christ. And then in 2013, Paul, who began over there at Biggers as he looking after the floors and the basketballs, he was named the senior minister. And he invited me to come and be a part of the staff and to work with them, which I did. And he had a couple of years to get started, and then the time came, it always does in your leadership, in your tenure, what are you going to do? Pastor, preacher, where are you going to take us? So the idea that there was going to be a capital campaign, a fundraiser, and it needed a target, it needed a vision. And Paul, working in conjunction with the Pastor Parish Relations Committee, he outlined some things that could possibly be done. Some involved global outreach, others local outreach, others regarding a new building up there on Hillcrest, some regarding the Leadership Institute and starting new churches. And he said, I'm going to go off and I'm going to pray about this. I'm going to wrestle with it. I'm going to come back having made a choice for what we're going to do in the vision. And I remember thinking, I'm rooting for that Leadership Institute. You know, I don't want to take away from the others, but I'm rooting for that Leadership Institute. I'd sure like to do that. And then the answer came. He returned and he announced to us, we're going to do it all. We're going to do it all. And it was astounding. You know, there's a Hebrew word that I learned in my stint in the New York Garment District on 37th Street. It's called chutzpah. It means audacity. It means a refusal to be intimidated. And I said to myself, what chutzpah? When you add it up, he's talking about a goal of $65 million. That's never been done before. But we added it all up. He went out and he spoke the vision and put it before this people of God. And the people of God banded together, everybody, from those who were quite affluent and able to write very large checks, and those who were only able to give a little bit, but proportionately the same. And together, we were able to raise that amount of money, and we've done it all. The Tollison building is there. The restoration ministries, the new parking garage, the Grove, the new church up in Northwest Dallas with Stephen Lohofer as the pastor, the Uptown Church. It is going on. It's being initiated with Joy Gonzalez and Elizabeth Mosley. They're gathering young people together. They're serving in the name of Christ. They're having prayer on the Katy Trail. They're watching Joy's weekly devotional. They're going to gather young people in Uptown. They're speaking the language that may initially sound foreign, but they're talking about what God has done in Jesus Christ and preaching the gospel, and they're going to gather together a new church. And then in the midst of that, Paul announced that Matt Tuggle would be our executive pastor. And Matt has done a stalwart job in helping us to discern goals for our church and our ministries and keeping us on track. So here's what we're going to do. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to pray for our senior minister. We're going to pray for Paul and Ashley and PJ and Arden and Luke. Understand that Paul is not incapacitated. He could easily have been here preaching this morning. But instead, what he's chosen to do is take a few weeks off to get in front of this thing, to speak with doctors, come up with a strategy, to talk about what sort of medicine he should be taking in order to manage this. And then within a few weeks, he will be returning in October. And it will coincide. We've been in the midst of this pandemic, going on 7 months now, our reopening effort. We have studied all the experts. We have taken Governor Abbott's mandates. We have followed them meticulously, which means that we'll also be skipping every other pew, sitting at socially distanced from each other. And then on a limited basis in October, we haven't announced the exact day, we will open up. Now listen carefully. Especially those of you who are older. We know that you are more vulnerable to this disease, and so we are in no way saying we expect you to be here on the day that we reopen. Not at all. What we're doing is we're inviting those people who are ready and in a place where they want to return, knowing that we are cautious and knowing that we will be safe. We invite you to come and attend as you are able and willing. If you want to continue to stay at home, that's fine. We will continue to have a streaming video of our service. So in October, we've got something to look forward to. The return of our leader, our pastor, our advocate, our friend. And then a return to being able to gather together. In a way, if you think about it, it's an opportunity to give it all away, to start all over again, to start a new chapter. And I, for one, am excited and wouldn't miss it for the world. For we are not ashamed of the gospel. Amen.